For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Okay, so let's start with some Rashis. As I mentioned, some critical Rashis as we go through. So our story begins in verse 1, Pasuk Aleph. The truth is, it really doesn't begin there. There was a lot of background, which we did not do, in terms of leading up to the days prior to the giving of the Aseret HaDibros. So I don't mean to say our story begins. But the first of the Aseret HaDibros, Vayidaber Elokim Eish Kol HaDvarim Ha'ele Le'mor Hashem spoke. Now we use a specific name of Hashem to describe that which is taking place. Who is speaking the Aseret HaDibros? There are many different names of God that are used often throughout the Chumash. Which name is used here? The name Vayidaber Elokim. Often the word that's used is the Yud in the Hay and the Vav in the Hay, which is the name of God, the name of Hashem that we use, which refers to Hashem's attribute of mercy or of creation. And here we have which attribute is used. Elokim refers to justice, judgment. And Rashi notes, we'll start off right away with, what an interesting thing. I don't know if I would have thrown the question out and you said, okay, here are the Ten Commandments. Which attribute should be the name to describe? I don't know. I guess we can make arguments for a number of different possibilities. But what we have is the attribute of God that's giving us the Ten Commandments is specifically the attribute of judgment. Says Rashi. Rashi has what to say on this. And God spoke, Ein Elokim El Adayin. The divine name Elokim, which is used here, means exclusively judge. That's always what that name of God refers to, is specifically God in his capacity as judge. Why? Lefi, skipping through two lines. Lefi sheyesh parshios batorah. Because there are passages of the Torah that contain commandments. She'im asa'an adam mekabel schar. If a person does, he receives reward. Vim lav, and if not, Einu mekabel alein puranos, he does not receive any punishment. They're almost what we would call, I don't want to use the word optional mitzvos because it has a connotation different than what I mean, but there are mitzvos, we'll come up with a couple of examples right now. If you do them, you receive reward, and if you don't, there's no punishment. Give me some examples. Tzitzis. What's the requirement for a man to wear tzitzis? When a man wears a four-cornered garment, he's obligated to put tzitzis on them. Let's say I'm not wearing a four-cornered garment. So there's a punishment if you wear a four-cornered garment without tzitzis. But if I'm not wearing tzitzis, so that would be a mitzvah in which Rashi is describing, if you do it, great reward. And if not, as long as you weren't wearing the four-cornered garment, what about the mitzvah of shechita, to slaughter an animal? When does that mitzvah apply? If you want meat. If you want to eat meat, there's a mitzvah to do it in a specific way. There's a bracha that we make because I'm fulfilling the mitzvah of shechita. Let's say I'm a vegetarian. So I just didn't fulfill that particular mitzvah because I don't have any opportunity to fulfill that mitzvah. There are many such mitzvahs like that in which if you go out of your, or if you create a scenario or you do it, you can fulfill a mitzvah. And if you don't, so then there's no punishment because it wasn't a violation of anything. I'll give you an interesting one, which you probably might not be aware of, is the mitzvah of mezuzah. Mitzvah mezuzah applies on your house. If you own a house, you put up a mezuzah. Let's say you don't own a house. So is that rabbinic or is that biblical? So if you don't own a house,
yes,
I'm just a renter. So then I don't have a house. It's not mine. So on a rabbinic level, I have to put up a mezuzah, which is what we do. But as far as the Torah is concerned, you don't have the area with which to put up a mezuzah, to fulfill the mitzvah. So there are many... Shuls don't have mezuzahs. I mean, we put them up often, but they don't have to have... So there are many types of mezuzahs. There are different types of mitzvahs. In the language, there's what we call a mitzvah chiyuvis. This is an obligation. You must do this. And then there are mitzvahs that, if the scenario presents itself, fulfill the mitzvah. And as we're bringing examples, there are many such mitzvahs like that. Just as an example, for a man to put on tefillin, that's what we call a mitzvah chiyuv. It's a must. Go out, get yourself a pair of tefillin, put them on every day. Tzitzis, as I mentioned, is, if you have four corners, put on tzitzis. There's no commandment, go out and do this. For example, lulav on sukkahs. So there's a commandment. Go get a lulav and shake the lulav on sukkahs. Go hear a shofar, go hear the... versus other mitzvahs, which are when the sin... Says Rashi, where do the Ten Commandments fit into that spectrum? Where does this fit, this series of sukkim that we're about to study, that we have been studying, where do they fit on that range? Says Rashi, Yochol afaseres hadibros kein. One might think that the Ten Commandments are also like this, that the commandments being said therein are, I don't want to use the word optional, but circumstantial, or if you do them, great, and if you don't do them, there's no particular punishment for them. Talmud lomar vayidabri elukim. That's why the word that's used, the name, the attribute of God that's used to introduce this particular paragraph is the name Elohim, that indicates a dayon lihi paro, a judge who exacts punishment for failure to keep the Ten Commandments. Now we asked a question, which was the capital B question, the elephant in the room when you begin learning the Aseres HaDibros. Now I'll just repeat it now as we introduce this first Rashi. There are 613 commandments in the Torah. Is number 608 important?
Yes.
Yes, thank you. The answer is yes. They're all important. They're all important. They're all critical. If a Sefer Torah is missing a single letter, the whole Sefer Torah is no good. It's a package deal. So what are the Ten Commandments? What is this concept of the Aseres HaDibros? And again, I use the word ten lightly in the sense of ten statements, but as we saw, there are more mitzvos than ten contained therein. What role do they play in Jewish life? Do I need to keep these ten things more than the others? Are they conceptually more important? Something. There's something about them that distinguishes the Aseres HaDibros from everything else. A, it's distinguished because where is it taught to us? At Har Sinai. As the Jews gather at Har Sinai to receive the Torah, this is what they're taught. So there's clearly something about them. They're the Aseres HaDibros they're referred to. And then that's our job, is to figure that out. So Rashi starts us off right away by saying, these items in this list are not on the list of things, if I get around to it, it would be a nice thing. Not on that list. This is on the list of, there's a judge who's telling you these things, who's ready to exact punishment from anyone who doesn't observe them. So the first clue that we have, Rashi tells us right away, to what these things are, is that they are have-tos, not want-tos or nice things. So far, so good? That's point one that Rashi tells us. Kol advarim ha'ela, the opening introductory verse also told us that God spoke all of these things. Rashi says a fascinating thing. All of these words, this teaches us that the Holy One, blessed is He, said all of the Ten Commandments in one utterance. Something which is impossible for man to say in like manner. There's something else unique about the Aseres HaDibros that makes him into a unit different from all the other units of the Torah, and that is, whatever is unique and special about them, they were all said b'dibur echad. What else was said b'dibur echad? Most famous one? What was said in one utterance? We say it every Friday night in Kabbalah Shabbos. Shamor v'zachor b'dibur echad. Shamor and Zachor were said b'dibur echad. There are two sets of Ten Commandments. One is in the parsha that we're studying in Shemot, and one is in the end of in the beginning of in the book of Devarim. So there are two separate times that it was said. One time when it discusses Shabbos, which is number four, it says the word Zachor es Yom HaShabbos, remember the Shabbos day. And another time it says Shamor es Yom HaShabbos, to guard Shabbos. And the sages say, don't think that Hashem switched His mind from one to the other. They were actually both said simultaneously at the same utterance. Says Rashi now, not just Shamor and Zachor were said in one utterance. The entirety of the Aseres HaDibros, going back to our big question, what's so special about these? Not sure yet, but whatever it is, not only are we told that it was taught by the judge,
it was the judge who told us this thing, but that he said them all as a package. There are units that intrinsically are all one.
Says Rashi, we'll talk about this in a second. Im Kain, if so, why does the Torah go on to say, I am Hashem your God, there shall not be any other gods unto you? We have them all delineated into separate statements. Says Rashi, page 234. Because he went back and specified each and every statement of the Ten Commandments individually. Okay, what we get from that, and there's what to talk about is, even though they were each then said individually, which was obviously necessary because the people would have never been able to understand anything had they not been delineated separately, but that, again, we have the idea of a unit. That somehow these Aseres HaDibros, the five on the one stone, the five on the other, are a single entity that are together. That they were taught by the judge, because you have to, and that by definition, if they were said in one utterance, there's somehow that package deal. Now, because this is only our third class, I don't really feel the need to give any answers yet. So we're still in question mode, but we're gathering information. I would say we're now at information gathering. That's a critical piece of information to be gathered, that they were all said together and somehow formed that unit. So far, so good? Let's move on. Lemor. So Hashem spoke these words, saying, this teaches us that the Israelites, the Jews, would answer yes to that which was positive, and no to that which was negative. So the word lemor, saying, Hashem spoke these words, saying, what's the word saying there? It's not, he's speaking them directly to the people. That's a hint, Rashi says, that there was another saying, so to speak, that was there. It was the response of the Jewish people. So, first they were said, b'dibur echa. They were said in a singular utterance, all of them. The people didn't understand what was going on. So Hashem delineated them one at a time for them. And then to each one that was a positive, they responded, we accept. To each one that was a prohibition, they said, we accept the prohibition. So that there was a dialogue, almost, so to speak, as the 10 statements, the 10 utterances were then being delineated to the people. After each one, they responded with an acceptance of what was being done, which again, of course, fits with the fact that it's being taught by a judge who's telling them, I will be here to extract punishment from you if you don't observe it. And they accepted that. Each one they said on the positives, yes. On the negatives, they said, no, we will not do so. Questions, comments?
But you know, you're saying it. What is it? But it's like the basics that we have to build on. And I don't know. That's what I think.
I'm not disagreeing with you. Nor saying that that's not fair. The question is, if we went through all of the interpersonal mitzvahs in the Torah, would we have come up with these five of don't steal, don't murder, don't testify falsely, don't covet your friend's things, and no adultery? Would those have been the five interpersonal statements that we would have come up with to say, be nice? That's the question. So if the answer is yes, I say, great, makes a lot of sense. If the answer is no, we would have come up with some other things, and we have to say, well, then what is this really, what are we being taught here?
I don't know, what are we being taught?
All right. We're moving as fast as we can. I agree, I'm not disagreeing with you. In other words, we need to understand, are these indeed the big five? So we could work backwards. We could say, if this is what the Torah is teaching us, they must be the big five.
Right.
And that is, some of them, again, are more obvious than others. Yeah, sure, don't kill, don't steal, no adultery, don't testify falsely, don't covet. I don't know that I would have come up with the don't testify falsely and don't covet as in my top five.
It's like the basis of lying. Once you start lying, you get into trouble. You know, like there are ways to avoid situations, you know, without lying, but, you know, bluntness is another thing. So, you know, it's telling you to be honest, to respect, you know, your parents. You know, it deals with family life, it deals with legalities and, you know, and those things for me stem.
I'm not going to argue with you.
You're giving answers, but
you
just want to question.
Well, you
asked a good one before.
Answer question. Okay, let's move on. Let's move on. Okay, so now we get to number one. Let's start with number one. What was number one again? I am Hashem, your God. Anoch Hashem Elokecha, asher hotzeisicha mi'eretz Mitzrayim. We took you out of Mitzrayim from the house of slaves. Now, we mentioned a couple of questions. Let's just go over the two big questions we asked on this particular verse of the number one of the 10 statements. What was the two questions we raised?
Why did it say who took you out of Egypt?
Excellent. What should it have said? I created heaven and earth. Why is it that God introduces to us in Himself to us in the Aseret HaDibros says the God who took us out of Egypt? And number two, we raise the question of, is this an actual commandment? This is statement number one out of the Aseret HaDibros. Is there anything to do in this statement?
There's no
action verb in this statement. It's a statement of fact. I am Hashem, your God, who took you out of Egypt from the house of slavery. Period. Let's take a look at Rashi. Rashi says, Asher hotzei sichem yarem Hashem, who took you out of the land of Egypt, kedai hi ha-hotza'a, shetihu mishu'avadim li. Taking you out of Egypt is sufficient reason for you to be subject to me. So it's Rashi's first response here. Why does God introduce us as the God who took us out of Egypt?
You owe me a lot.
Right? That's all you need to know. You don't even know anything else. Doesn't matter. I created heaven and earth. That's very nice. But the fact that you now are mishubad, are subject to me, why is that? I have one reason alone to say that, and that is I took you out of Mitzrayim. And now, there's another reason, once you bring it into that form. What else is more, I don't know how to phrase this as a question, just state it as a fact. What's more relevant to me, that there's a God who created heaven and earth 6,000 years ago, or that He gave me a job and a house to live in and a family? So if you put it on the scale as to, you know, which one is bigger, more important, that's one scale. But I'm not asking bigger, more important. I'm asking relevance. I want to know what speaks to me. What will make me more loyal? So that's a different question. If you're looking for loyalty, if you're looking for a reason to be willing to subjugate myself to someone else, so you can talk big stuff, or you can tell me, I'm giving you a paycheck. I'm providing you with a house that gives you shelter from the elements. That talks to me. So says Rashi, you know what's kedai, you know what's worth it alone, sufficient reason for you to subjugate yourself to me? I took you out of Egypt. Who's God talking to right now? Who's He talking to? Right? He's talking to the people that left Mitzrayim 7 weeks ago. After 210 years of slavery, 7 weeks ago they left Egypt. So Rashi says, so when He introduces Himself and He says, I got some demands on you, this is not going to be easy. We're going to build a society, and it's going to be a just, moral, fair society. How does He introduce Himself? He says, I took you out of Egypt. So Rashi right away starts with, I think we would have come up with this on our own as well, in terms of what the advantages of an introduction from Egypt versus I created heaven and earth. Says Rashi number two, Dover Achra. So I have another reason why, says Rashi, God introduced Himself in such a manner. Alternatively, God identifies Himself through the Exodus, Lefisha Nigle Bayom Kigibor Milchama, because He revealed Himself at the parting of the sea as a mighty warrior. Venigle Khan Kizakin Mole Rachamim. And He revealed Himself here as an old man full of mercy. As the verse says, and beneath His feet there was that which had been in the form of a brick of sapphire. There are many images that we receive of God throughout this story, that the Jews themselves, as they left Egypt, received from God. Different traits that He displayed. As we ourselves are talking about the traits of the judge, the traits of mercy, of a father, of a master. It's a complex relationship that we have with God in the terms of the roles that He plays in life and the way that He displays Himself to us. So says Rashi, we'll let the sea, which happened 6 weeks prior, splitting of the sea happened a week after the Exodus of Egypt, so 6 weeks prior, what was the image they saw of God there at the sea? Says Rashi, there they saw a mighty warrior. They saw God taking vengeance out against the Egyptians, pouring His wrath out, stirring them up in the water, spewing them forth on the other side of the banks. They saw a mighty warrior. What do they see now as they approach Har Sinai 6 weeks later? Says Rashi, as an old man full of mercy. Very different image. And he quotes the verse, the Torah describes that underneath his feet was this black sapphire. Rashi there in that verse comments that the brick sapphire underneath his feet was to remind him of the bricks that the Jewish people were always forced to work. He kept it as a reminder underneath him, so to speak, that he should always see the pain and suffering of his children. It should be always, whatever that means, that God needed that to remind himself of that. So they see a different image. There is the image of the warrior, the image of the elderly father full of mercy. Rashi continues, this brick was before him at the time of the enslavement as a sign of God's suffering along with the Israelites in their bondage. There's many statements that Rashi quotes that when the Jewish people suffer, so to speak, God himself, Kaviyachol, suffers along with us. That's a very different image of God than the mighty warrior. Sometimes the image of the heavens was before him once they were redeemed. Since I change appearances, says God, do not err and say there are two divine powers. That's one of the difficulties that we have. And again, we find this statement often in quoted in Rashi based on the Talmudic sources of the concept of idolatry, the concept of different gods is not a complete made up foreign what were they thinking type of thought. Because we find from the earliest stages of our sources that God himself has attributes. The 13 attributes of God. God teaches them himself to Moshe after the sin of the golden calf. Say these attributes, learn these attributes, and emulate these attributes. There's the name of God that's Elohim, judge. There's the name of God of Hashem, full of mercy. Kel Shakai. They're different names of God that refer to different attributes. So it's only a slight deviation from the true understanding of that till a person would come to the conclusion of there are different divine powers, heaven forbid. And that's where idolatry came from. There were different elements. So we find often that whenever you have the potential for that mistake, you find God putting in place that which is necessary, so to speak, to correct it. So here, Rashi points out, why do we have the language of I took you out of Egypt? Because you might have said by the time you got here, your heads are spinning. First you saw me as a man of war at the splitting of the sea. Then you see me as this elderly, gentlemanly father, grandfather, full of compassion. Says Rashi, you might have thought, since I change appearances, that there are two divine powers. Although I have appeared differently to you since then, Anochi Asher Hotseisicha Mimitzrayim V'al Hayom. I am the one who took you out of Egypt, and I am the one whom you saw on the sea. It's all the same. It's all the same. That's the complexity of the God that we have. The complexity of I lack words. It's a clumsy. It's complex, but it's one at the same time. So I could say those words, and you can say, yeah, I understand that, and we don't really understand that, but that's what it is. At the same time that we say, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, that it's all one, we also say, well, there's the attribute of mercy, there's the attribute of justice, how does that work? Echad. So you find at the beginning of the Seres HaDibros, this unit which was said all at the same time by the judge, also was, and who am I introducing myself to you? The one who took you out of Egypt. The same one who took you out of Egypt, the same one who split the sea, the same one who you see now in the attribute of mercy, is all Chod. Okay, so far so good. That's explanation number two. So explanation number one, why does he introduce himself as Egypt? That's all you need to know to be Meshubah to me. That's all you need to know to subjugate yourself to me. I took you out of the slavery. Number two, because I want to say that even though you see me now looking a little different than you did over then, I'm still the same one. It's all one and the same. One last thing, says Rashi, Dabar Acher. Alternatively, God identifies himself through the Exodus of Fishahayu Shoimin Kolos Harbe. The Jews heard many sounds at the time of the revelation at Mount Sinai. As the Pasuk says, Es HaKolos, all the sounds, and this was from the introductory verses which we skipped, which describe the days leading up to the revelation, in which there was this, on the mountain, there was this shofar, gadol, this great shofar blowing numerous sounds. Kolos, boyin, me'ar, baruchos, and the sounds came from the four directions, from the north, south, east, and west, umin, hashamayim, umin, ha'aretz, from the heavens, and down from the earth. So from all six directions these sounds were emanating. Al tomru rishuyos harbehen. Don't err to say there are many divine powers. It is all still me, one and the same. So far so good? Okay, so three reasons Rashi gives us why he introduces himself to us as the God who took us out of Egypt. That's all we need to know, because he did. It's relevant to teach us that it's all one, and to teach us again that it's all one, that even though there are sounds coming from everywhere, it's all really still that same one God. Okay. Asks Rashi, V'lama Omar Lashon Yachid Elokecha. Why did he say these commandments in the second person singular, as in, I am your God? As if he were speaking to 600,000 individual Jews, rather than saying them in the second person, plural, Elokechem. I am your God, but you are plural. Why does he speak as if he's speaking to an individual? Says Rashi, Litain Pischon Peh, so as to provide an opening for Moshe to offer a defense of the Jewish people regarding the incident of the golden calf. And this is what Moshe meant when he said in their defense, why, Hashem, does your anger burn against your people? Lo lohem tzivisa lo yelohem Elohim acherim. You did not give the command that there shall not be other gods for you to them, Elali levadi, but to me alone. Very, very interesting Rashi. Rashi says, it's as if Moshe can say, you didn't talk to them, you were talking to me alone. You said it singular, there shall not be any other gods to you, so that Moshe will have an opening to be able to say, well, since it wasn't directed towards them, maybe it was only directed towards me, we should let him off the hook. Now this is going to need some explanation, which we're not going to do today, but that's Moshe's big defense. We have to understand this, that Moshe's going to have, that because it was said singular, that maybe they didn't know that they weren't allowed to do that. How is that going to serve as a defense? I'll have to get back to that. Yes?
They just answered yes and no.
100%. So we'll leave that for now, and we'll get back to that point as we start seeing some other commentators. Okay. One more in this verse. Mi beis avadim, from the house of slaves. I don't want to do that first one. You don't need to do that. Okay, lo yelcha. Okay. You know, I'm going to quickly run through this. I thought I had more on these first three. I want to do another one. Let me just make another quick copy. Let me pause this, and I'll be right back. That wasn't recorded, so I have to say that whole thing over again. All right. So it goes. Okay, verse 3. Verse 3, which is now the beginning of our second of the Aseret Hadibros. Now remember, this second of the Dibros, of the statements, was several verses long. So we can read it all together. Was several verses long. You shall not have any other gods of others in my presence. You shall not make for yourself a graven image or any picture of that which is in the heaven above or on the earth below or in the water beneath the earth. Which we went through and we discussed, so we have here, not just, you shall not have any other gods, you can't then make graven images of anything, heavens, earth, or in the water. Verse 5, you shall not prostrate yourself to them, nor worship them. Two more verbs. Cannot prostrate, cannot worship. For I am Hashem, your God, a zealous God, who visits the sin of fathers upon the children, third, fourth generations, those who hate me. But with kindness for thousands of generations to those who love me and observe my commandments. So we had a lot to say on this particular, this second of the Ten Commandments. We have a number of different verbs. I think we counted four or five. Not to have, not to make, not to prostrate, not to worship. Then we had this other idea of me being a zealous God, that God says, who visits this iniquity for three and four generations, but kindness I do for much more. Those are all the comments that we had raised when we discuss this. Let's see what Rashi has to say about this particular verse, beginning on page 235. Ready? Here we go. Lo yelucha, there shall not be unto you other gods. Lama nemer, why was this said? We have all of these, so many different verses discussing the prohibition of idolatry. Says Rashi, because it is said in the following verse, you shall not make for yourself a graven image. The very next pasuk, We're doing Pasuk 3, verse Pasuk Gimel now. The very next verse says, don't make for yourself a graven image. Well, if you already tell me not to make for myself a graven image, what's learned by verse 2, which says, you shall not have any images or any foreign gods? Says Rashi, well, if you only had the second verse, that you shall not make, then you would have concluded that the prohibition is to make an idol. What is the source for saying that one should not keep an idol that has already been made? So that's our verse. There shall not be unto you. Lo yihye lecha, you simply cannot have. So if you moved into a house and there was an idol in it, and the owner says to you, everything in the house is now yours. So I didn't make this idol. I don't even believe in this idol. What's my responsibility? Right. How do you know that? So if you say, from where? I don't believe in it. I didn't make it. I didn't put it here. Where is the obligation upon me to get rid of it? That's this verse. Lo yihye lecha. You cannot have any other idol here. Which means, so it's not just a prohibition against your making, but just it simply cannot be.
It say it was made out of a gem or something, and you have to. Could you use that for jewelry?
Not if it's been actually worshipped. One of the elements of idolatry is that there are many items in the Torah which are prohibited to us. Most items, without just making up a number, 90-95% of prohibited items are not prohibited for us to benefit from. They're just prohibited from us to do whatever it is that is normally done. Let's say, for example, you have McDonald's. McDonald's serves non-kosher meat. So am I allowed to benefit from McDonald's? Can I derive benefit? Meaning to say, if somebody gave me a gift of a McDonald's cheeseburger, or just say regular burger, am I allowed to give it to somebody who works for me who's not Jewish, that they should be able to have it? Yeah, I can give it. I can do that. Idolatry is different. Idolatry, there's a prohibition of getting any benefit from. Once something's been actually worshipped as an idol, so then it needs to be destroyed, and you're not allowed to get any benefit from it. So yes, if there were such a gem, then you would not be able to get any benefit from it.
Right.
Is
giving it as a gift for a benefit?
Correct, sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Well, the person is benefiting.
Sure are you. Sure you are.
Oh, well, what if you gave it an honestly?
Okay, if you can come up with a scenario in which you actually got no benefit from it, then fine, but then you don't have to ask yourself, why are you doing it?
Again.
You have to ask yourself, why are you doing that?
Because he knows somebody would, appreciate it.
But
it's not as you appreciate it.
But
if they know it, and if it's
it gets very tricky.
Okay.
And generally, I would say the answer to that is going to be no.
Okay.
But that you just have to work out why that would be. Okay, continues Rashi. Good, because if we did, we'd take a field trip to smash them. And that'd be yeah.
Thank you.
You may not have other gods of others. Now, what does it mean, gods of others? Rashi says this means she'enan elohus. They're not really divine. In other words, if you literally translated the words Elohim acherim, how would that translate into other gods? The Torah is prohibiting me from having other gods. Meaning, there are other gods out there. You're not permitted to have them. That's how the words literally translate. Rashi says, that's odd. We just got through all of these statements saying, I'm one, there is nothing else, all that. What do you mean, what is that? How does that phrase, you may not have other gods? It should have said, you may not have other, false pretenders who seem to have powers in front of it. Well, let's come up with some word that would describe that. When you use the word Elohim Acherim, you're actually saying you may not have any other gods. As if there are other gods, but you can't have them. Rashi says that's why you need to understand how to translate the word. The way you translate the words is as follows. Says Rashi, they are not divine, but others make them gods over them. What does Elohim Acherim, other gods, mean? Things that others make into gods, you may not have them. So anything that someone else makes into a god, you can't then have either. Even though it really isn't a god, but you can't have something that someone else makes into a god. It is impossible to explain the term as other gods, that is,
gods other than myself, for it is an affront towards him who is above all to even call them gods alongside him. So, therefore, the translation is Elohim, things that other, that acherim, that others make into gods over them, you may not have. So anything, this is always where you get into like modern terminology, anything that the world around us deems a god, we can't have as that. Now, we have all of us, we have our, in today's mind, we have our modern day gods. Whether they be sports figures, or stock market, or power, whatever it is, there's something else that you put your trust into. Whatever is out there that others put their trust into, you may not have before me. Davar Acher, an alternative explanation, what does it mean, Elohim Acherim? An alternative explanation of other gods is Heim Acherim Lo'ovdeyem, that they are others to those who worship them. What does that mean, that they are others or strangers to those who worship them? That their worshippers cry out to them, but they do not answer them. And it is as if their God were an other who never knew the worshipper. And what's Rashi trying to do? He's trying to explain the literal translation of Elohim Acherim, other gods. What does it mean, other gods? So the first explanation is that others, meaning other people, make into gods. That's what the phrase Elohim Acherim, that Acherim, that others make into gods. Now he says, you know what it means? They're gods who treat their worshippers as others. I mean, they're strangers to them. That the people call out and beseech these gods for whatever that they need. And the gods, so to speak, behave as if they don't know them and don't respond. Why is it they really not respond? Because they have no ability to respond. But it looks like they're behaving as others towards them, without any ability to respond. Al Ponai, what does it mean that you may not have any of these gods before me? This apparently superfluous phrase means Kol Zman Sha'ani Kayom, all the while that I exist, then you shall not say, none were commanded regarding idolatry except that generation present at Sinai. There are many, not many, there are a handful of mitzvahs that we find in the Torah that are generation specific. That the generation that left Egypt and traveled through the desert, they received certain instruction, but the instructions they received did not transfer into the land. It's a small handful of mitzvahs, and Rashi is always careful to point them out, the differences that were during the generation in the desert and that which actually continued. So Rashi points out, why does the language say you shall not have any other gods in my presence, al panoi, to make it very clear. This is not a generational commandment. It's not to the generation, not just to the generation that left Egypt that we say, you can't have any other gods. You're coming from this idolatrous land. So to you, I have to cleanse from all other gods, but it won't apply to generations later living in the land already. No, as long as I exist, which is forever, as long as I'm around, you can't have anything else.
Isn't that unusual that it said all the while that I exist? It brings a question. You mean that he might not exist?
Yeah, no, it's a fair point you're raising. It's a poetic language of as long as I'm here, you can't do that. So when you speak about God meaning forever, the sages use that as well. There's a pasuk of the requirement to learn Torah, v'higisa bo yomam v'layla, that you should delve into it during the night and during the day. So there's a Talmudic passage which discusses, in one of the many topics, that's a hot button topic of studying other things other than Torah. Am I allowed to do so? So one opinion the Gemara expresses is, sure, if you can find a time that's not day and not night, go right ahead and study whatever you want. But otherwise, during the V'yigisa bo yomam v'layla, you need to toil in Torah day and night. So that's that same type of phrase of, sure, whenever you find a time that's not day or not night, you can do what you want. So whenever God's not around, yeah, you can have other idols. Great. So that's a poetic way of expressing it as, I ain't going anywhere, I'll always be here, and therefore you're never prohibited to have any other type of idols around. Okay, moving into verse 4. Now we got into the action verbs. You cannot create an image, a graven image, or any picture. So what are these, images or pictures? Rashi explains to us. A pestle is a carved image. It is called a pestle because it is sculpted. So you can't have any type of sculpture.
Haggadah is from Pussel? Pussel is, or is Pussel Yiddish?
Pussel is not Yiddish. It is a word that you find in the Mishnah and the Gemara.
It's the same.
I don't know the relationship, though, between the word pussel, which means disqualified, and pestle, which means like a carved image. Okay, so what are you not allowed to have, or any picture of anything that is in the heaven?
What?
Oh, stars, moon, sun.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Didn't the Sanhedrin have pictures of the moon at least to test the people?
Yes, very good. So now this question, in practical terms, is going to be a very important question. So what are the implications of this? The verse says, you may not have a graven image or a picture of anything in the heaven, in the earth, or in the waters. So if you have a sculpture in your house of a fish, or you have a sculpture of a tree, is that sculpture prohibited by the Aseret HaDibros? Is that within? Now, you have no idolatrous intention. The person who made it had no idolatrous intention. The person who made it because they went to an arts class and they made a sculpture of a tree, or of a flower, or of a star, or of a fish, whatever it may be. Where is the practical implication of the verse that you're all thinking, oh boy, I got to go through my whole house, I got to throw that out, I got to throw this out. What are the practical implications of this? And that is a very important discussion. The simple reading of the verse would be a sculpture of a specific image of something in the heavens or the earth or the sea would be indeed a problem. Let's do a little bit more because we had a little break in the middle, yeah?
What about a picture of it?
Also, or a picture of it. Now again, the same practical implications would be, so a picture in the times of the Torah and the Mishnah, the Gemara, was one that was actually drawn. What if I take a snapshot? So it's a snapshot of a star or of the fish. Is that now a picture of something that you're not allowed to have pictures of fish in your house? These are important questions. Let's do a little bit more. I'm a zealous God, Mikana Lipora. He is zealous to exact punishment and does not bypass his attribute of strict judgment to forgive the sin of idolatry. There is an attribute we've been discussing a lot about different attributes of God. There's an attribute of mercy. There's an attribute that's willing to overlook sin. So Rashi tells us, why is it so wordy here in the Aseret HaDibros when he talks about idolatry and he says, I'm a zealous God? I'm here to tell you, there are times when I am willing to overlook, there are times when I can forget and forgive, and there are times when I will not. And I'm zealous about idolatry. Not willing to overlook it. For those who hate me, this is to be understood as it is rendered by the Targum, that he remembers the sin of the fathers against the children, k'she'uchzin ma'asei avoseim bi'adeyem, when are the children punished for the sins of their fathers? When they hold the deed of the fathers in their hands, meaning they maintain their father's sinful behavior. We ask that as a question, what do you mean the punishment? 3-4 generations later, why would the children be punished for the sins of their father? When are sons punished for the sins of the father? Only if they maintain those behaviors, then not only do they get it for themselves, so then it accumulates and accrues from the sins of the fathers. And he guards kindness that a person does to pay reward to the descendants of one who did the kindness until 2,000 generations. And it thus turns out that the Midatova, the God, the aspect of doing good for people is greater than the aspect of punishment by a ratio of 1 to 500. For this one persists for 4 generations and this one for 2,000. So the second of the Ten Commandments concludes with, as Rashi tells us, this idea of being a vengeful, zealous God, meaning idolatry is not something I'm willing to overlook. I take it seriously. And my midah, my trait of repaying sin to generations that maintain their father's behavior is 500-fold that 500-fold less than what it is when a person does kindness and follows in my way. Their children will be repaid up to 500 generations later. The merit continues to accrue, but when it comes to sins, only for the 3 or 4 generations. Okay, those are Rashi's comments on the first 3 of our Aseret HaDibros. We, God willing, will continue next week.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, And if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.